Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode focusing on an incredible rescue mission in North Vietnam a half century ago, because the helicopter pilot who was awarded the Navy Cross as a result is about to experience a very different kind of mission, his honor flight to Washington, D.C. Make sure to check out the upcoming honor flights wherever you live. I have links for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And if that happens to be in Central California, you can join me in welcoming home helicopter pilot Harry Zinser and 68 other veterans from Vietnam, the Korean War, the Cold War, and even World War II on September 13th at Fresno Yosemite International Airport. Get there by 5:30 to find a good spot. The plane should land by 6 p.m. and they'll come marching through around 7. We're going to get back to his rescuer's perspective in a moment, but while Harry and his HH-3A helicopter crew were en route, that downed pilot they were searching for, Jim Lloyd, was in the middle of a nightmare very few of us could even fathom.
And so I told the A-7s, I said, my thinking was, bomb on the other side of the rice paddies. One of them went in, dropped 2 500-pounders, and they were just tremendously loud. I'd seen them going off, obviously, from the air for almost half a year, but boy, on the ground, they were terrifying, the noise and the shockwave. But the light scared me the worst because it lit me up. I could see people, faces and everything all around me looking that direction. I said, knock it off, it's not going to work. I had been in that area for about an hour, and like I said, it was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock at night now, and I had to get out by daylight. There's no way somebody like me could hide in the daytime. So I'd been watching 11 North Vietnamese about 40 yards from me, and the reason I know there are 11 of them is I assigned each one a number so I could keep track of them, because I don't want to get on the radio and have one or two of them close by and hear or see me. When they all be clumped together, I talked lowly on the radio. Well, I made sure they were all clumped together, and I said I got to move north. And the only reason I went north is because it just seemed to be quieter. So I slowly snuck away, leaving the voices behind me. When they disappeared to silence, I took off at a dead run. And I went up probably an eighth of a mile, maybe a quarter of a mile, and got down to call them and tell them I was on the move. And I made an almost fatal mistake. I took my two survival radios, two water bottles, took them on my survival gear, my vest, because the vest was making all kinds of noise, and I dumped the vest and tucked the water bottles and the radios in my Anna blackout suit and my pant legs, and they'd slipped out, all of them. And without a radio, there was no rescue. And so I slowly turned around, and I worked my way back. There was clumps of grass and all over the place. There was people all over the place. Well, I used the voices of those 11 men that I left behind to vector me into the same little spot, the same little clump of grass that I'd been hiding in. I couldn't see. It was so dark. And I groped around with my hands, and my right hand came across the stronger of the two radios. I would have taken either one of them and retreated a second time.
And let me stop you here, because this is the part of your story that I think gets me the most. And I'm interested to hear from you later which element of it is the most mind-blowing to you. But as I try to put myself in your shoes, if I've left this hiding spot behind, I'm trying to get away from these guys, it's pitch black, I have no idea where anything is, and then I realize I lost my radio. I don't think I would have had any reasonable expectation or hope of recovering it in that situation. What told you that you could actually do this and go find that radio again?
You know, that's an interesting question, because you know, at the time, I just figured I'd find it. I look back through the years, and that's one of those what-ifs that really, really I find scary, you know, because I can't imagine going the rest of the night without a radio, knowing that daylight is, it was like being executed at dawn. When the sun came up, you were gone, and there was no hope for rescue, and the sound of the planes would disappear, because they would assume that I was either killed or captured, and they're not going to risk any more planes in such a dangerous area if they don't have any confirmation that I was still alive and still free.
So that moment when you're groping around in the dark and your hand grabs a hold of that radio again, what did that feel like?
Well, it was obviously a feeling of relief. You know, if that was the end of it, that would have been even really a greater relief, but it was just the beginning of the next steps. But at least I had hope. And I never left that radio again. I didn't tuck it anywhere. I never left my, I didn't even switch hands with it. I had a grip on that until the last minutes in North Vietnam. So I continued moving, and I'd be out in these rice paddies, and the water is probably 8, 12, 24 inches deep. It varied. Real slimy bottom, real slimy. And I'd fall down in the water, make all kinds of racket, and I'm moving away. There's people around, but not right around me because I'm moving away from them. And I just wanted to get out of there. Heading north, I had a little wrist compass. I thought, I can't do this. It's just making too much noise. I got to find some way to travel quieter. Well, I realized that there's these partitions between rice paddies are a few feet wide, and they're high and dry. And I got on those, and God, I could make a really good time. I was quiet. I'd be hunkered down low to look up against the dark sky to see any light clothing so I could see anybody that might be approaching before they see me. And I was doing this for close to an hour when I heard, I was in the middle of two rice paddies, and I heard voices coming, noise. And I looked back, and two soldiers were on the same partition I was on, walking toward me. And I couldn't run. If I got in the water, they'd hear me splash. I just crawled to the side as far as I could of that little partition. I laid down in the prone position, held my breath, and I prayed. And I felt them walk by me. Then they stopped. A question was asked in Vietnamese. They walked back, and they stood over me. And then they jabbed me in the back with a rifle. And that is a feeling I can't even put in words of how hideous that feeling is. Again, Seer taught me I didn't want to be caught. And I was in a bad situation before, but I was free, and it was all over. And the thought came to my mind, I'm okay. I didn't know I had injured my neck, but I was still very mobile. I'm just going to lay here. They're going to have to carry me. Well, they jabbed me a second time, and when I didn't move that time, they argued. They started arguing. And then I heard what I thought was one running off, and then I could hear another group of soldiers about 40 yards off. I thought the individual was running too. And I figured now is my only chance. There's one guy standing over me. So I mustered all the courage I can get and rolled over as fast as I can to grab the guy's gun, fully expecting to be shot. And I was alone. And I remember my feeling was 95% relief and 5% foolish. I just thought, what if I just laid there not knowing they were gone? They had both run off not knowing, thinking that I was going anywhere, and they were competing for credit. Well, they only went about 40 yards until the guys that they found my body, I guess. Well, I got up and took off, and I ran down that partition. They couldn't see me, but they could hear me, and I could hear them shooting, and they all were firing in my direction. And the bullets were random, because some of them came real close to my ears, other ones thumping in the mud. I got down to the end of the rice paddy, and they were chasing me on the same little partition. I made a 30-degree angle cut, and they went straight, and I lost them. All I said on the radio was, you can't believe what I just went through. So I had to continue going.
Let me stop you there for a second, because we can't believe what you just went through either. And there's a couple elements of that I want to add to. So you said the two Vietnamese soldiers, you believe, were arguing over credit, because they could be rewarded financially if they brought you in.
I was told that we were, as officers, we were worth $500 if we were captured alive. You know, that's a lot of money for them. I like to think I'm worth a little more than 500, but hey, I can't argue. But anyway, and again, because they jabbed me in the back and I didn't react. So they figured I was incapacitated. So they weren't worried about me escaping.
And you mentioned how awful that feeling was. Can you help describe that for us, what it felt like when they jabbed you in the back? It's more than physical pain you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it's emotional. It's a feeling of being caught and... you know, by the enemy, you know you're going to be in the mercy of the enemy. They could do whatever they want to you. I knew in that area that I was a little too far from Hanoi Hilton. I probably wouldn't survive. I wouldn't be around much longer. They'd probably just execute me right there. And so I just figured it was over with. I had nothing to lose. That's why I was able to roll over, you know, get the courage to roll over and face that gun and hopefully knock it to the side and see what happened. I had lost my .38, unfortunately, when I... took off my survival vest. And as it turned out, that was probably a good thing because they would have heard it. But at the moment there, I wish I had it. I remember thinking about that. And then I just, like I said, I just took off. I can't believe how fast I was able to run to get away from all that.
And one more question before we move on to the next element of this saga. You said as you're lying there face down in the mud, they're jabbing you in the back with a rifle. But you said something. You said that you prayed. And I'm always fascinated by this. And maybe you don't even remember what you prayed. But when guys describe a situation like this, I try to say, well, what would I pray in that moment? What does a guy pray when he's in that helpless and seemingly hopeless of a situation?
Well, obviously, I'm praying for something good to come out of it. In other words, not to get killed, not to be captured, whatever. And I'm an average person when it comes to religion. I certainly believe, but I'm not somebody that pushes my beliefs down other people's throats or any of that kind of stuff. But the old saying is there's no atheists in a foxhole is very true. Your situations that by then I felt I was being looked after. I mean, there was no way that the decisions I made and the situations that happened would turn out in favor of me consistently like that, even up to this point. And it continued all night.
Yeah, and thank you for going there with me, because that fascinates me. And maybe other people get a hint of this in their life where they end up against something that they have zero control over. And I mean, if there's ever a situation where you're not in control, even though all these decisions you made led to your survival, it sounds like that's where you were in that moment, that there's not much else you can do and you need some help beyond yourself.
There was absolutely nothing else to do but roll over or, you know, and it was maybe my prayers were answered and it gave me the courage to roll over. Maybe I wouldn't have done that. And, you know, years later, decades later, I think back of that. And so I think, what if I didn't get the courage to do that? I just lay there. Of course, they'd all be right there and got me. You know, and here I had a slim chance. And somehow I had the ability to take advantage of it. So it was good fortune.
Yeah. So you go from face down in the dirt with bayonets in your back to escaping these guys. So now, but you're still not free. And you know that there's only a few hours left. So what happened next?
Well, I'd be going through these fields. I would say I'm wading through a rice paddy. It's 2 feet deep. I'd hear off the distance, North Vietnamese. They'd be spread out, and they'd be yelling. They'd be banging things. I thought I heard my name being called. I don't know if that was that or it was a Vietnamese word that sound like it, but I want to emphasize the human mind and body is absolutely phenomenal when it's pumped up like that with adrenaline and you're going through a life-threatening situation. I could hear everything. I could sense everything. I'd see them coming and I'd hold my breath when they got close, duck down in that putrid water. I'd literally feel them walking by when I couldn't hold my breath anymore. They didn't know I was there. They were looking for me. When I couldn't hold my breath anymore, I'd slowly come up and I'd see them walking away from me. They went by me. Again, one of them could have stepped on me and found me, but that didn't unfortunately happen. And then I would continue on, and I did that several times during the night. I started feeling then as, you know, I may get out of this. There's just too many things that are going my way just for it to end in failure. And I just want to mention the putrid water. The North Vietnamese fertilized those fields with human excrement for centuries. And basically, the analogy I use is I spent the night hiding in the basement of an outhouse, but it was the only cover I could find, and it's certainly the better of the alternatives. So anyway, after a few hours, I was really getting nervous. It was about daylight coming. It was about 2:30 in the morning. I got to a sort of a dry spot, and I pulled out my radio. I heard planes all night. They were flying all night. I called out on the radio, and I said, I think this is as good as it's going to get. It's kind of quiet here. You can go ahead and try to bring the helicopter in. I sat down. I remember slumping down and my adrenaline started leaving me and I literally ached from one end to the other. I was tired. I was worn out. Again, the adrenaline was a real shot in the arm and I was losing it. The 2A7s that were over there flew 5 hours for me and refueled air-to-air, refueled several times to be there for me. And that's a long, long time for a single-seat aircraft that we flew. Now, an A6 intruder, which is two people, the commanding officer of the squadron, Commander Ernst, and his Lieutenant Commander Grady Jackson, his bombardier navigator, took over command, unseen command, and they were overhead. And I remember saying, "It's go ahead and bring them in." And one of them came back and said, "Roger, Jim, it'll be 30 minutes. Just take it easy." And I thought, oh, take it easy. Well, one of three things is going to happen, and two weren't good. One was either in 30 minutes I'm going to be killed, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be captured, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be rescued. And I thought, wow, this is going to be exciting. And I just turned 27 6 days before, and I realized that, you know, there's a good possibility that in a half hour I might not get any older. So that, with the adrenaline going, despair started to take over. And I want to just emphasize one thing that I learned. Despair is the worst thing that could ever happen to you. That's like, there's no hope. It's all over with. I can't help it. You know, you lose it. Fear, on the other hand, is one of your strongest allies. It hones your thinking, your instincts. You become an animal. As I mentioned, I'm so thankful that I was able to do that. And fear was one of my driving forces. And I found a big difference between the two. Well, despair was starting to hit in. I started to hear planes flying over. They were starting to stack up. They were getting ready to come in. With the sound of the planes, the North Vietnamese would hear that, and they figured that's where I was, so they moved. I had found out when I'd called in, found out later through air intelligence, that I was exactly 2 miles from where I landed my parachute to where I was calling in for the helicopter at that point. I have no idea how many miles, additional miles, I made zigzagging to get there. But the fatigue was there. I mean, so when they started stacking up, I started thinking, I don't know how I'm even going to see the helicopter. My helicopter training was in the daytime in the jungle. How was it going to work at nighttime in the open fields with the enemy all around?
That is a very good question. And we'll get the answer from both Jim Lloyd on the ground there behind enemy lines and from Harry Zinser, the helicopter pilot who risked his life to save Jim's, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.